if you don't already know, I'm Rebecca Mercury, and my primary fields of expertise are microprocessor-based real-time systems and computer security, and so voting machines come under those bailiwicks. Fit quite nicely, actually. With regard to computer security, so I like to look at this whole aspect of the voting system standards in that respect. I'm not going to address just security aspects, but in looking at it from a security standpoint, we know it was a great paper by Peter Neumann and I think one other fellow who had identified that there are these gaps. And the gaps are, there are three types of gaps, and I'll explain what I mean by the gaps. But the gaps basically are sociological, technological, and socio-technical. And the gaps essentially are the distance, or you know, the gap between what the expectations are in each of those areas and what those areas are capable of delivering. So for example, the technical or the technological, you know, we would expect that the voting machines could record the votes accurately and never lose any votes, but we know that there's a gap because we know sometimes they do lose data and cartridges, you know, go, you know, get corrupted, etc. So there are these gaps. And then there's the sociological gaps, which is our sociological expectations for elections, but we know that there can be corruption and that sort of thing. And then the socio-technical is the combination of sociological problems with technological problems. And I'll address some of these with regard to some of the gaps that I also see in the voting system standards. So I'm going to look at this from this standpoint of the gaps. But first of all, we need to try to at least address, since we haven't even talked about it at all here, is why do these gaps exist? Now, the technological ones, they exist just because of technology. But the gaps in the voting system standard, and I threw out a few here, I said, you know, they could stem from, and these are, you know, they may be these, there may be, you know, hundreds more. But misunderstandings regarding technology, what things it can and cannot accomplish, procedures and policies and how these interact in voting systems, the desire to accommodate diverse special interest groups and election equipment stakeholders, a general orientation toward legacy balloting designs, the inability to reconcile constraints that are mutually unsatisfiable, all these types of things, and you know, we could sit here and brainstorm many, many more. Now, I'm not going to try to address that in my talk, but I think that if you start to look at how we got to this standard where it is basically coming from the legacy, and it describes this, you know, very eloquently in the opening parts of the standard itself, that, you know, from the 1990 standard to the 2002 to the 2005. So there were various things at play there, and the original standard was really for three different legacy types of voting system designs. And, you know, looking at those in the framework of the 1990 mindset, which was well pre-Bush versus Gore and Florida and Hanging Chad and all of that. So when you look at the how we got to the standard that we have today, we have to think of it in terms of that legacy and progression. And so if you think about it that way, then a lot of the things that we've discussed here, and some of them, you know, were sort of preempted, I had this, you know, sort of checklist, and a lot of the things on the checklist were discussed by many of the people, and people on both sides of the fence. So the top one was form versus function, or as people described it here, performance versus design. And there have been many discussions and arguments about should the standard be a performance standard, should it be a design standard. So, you know, it's much easier to design something to a design standard if they tell you how to design it, but if we don't really know what performance we're expecting to get out of it, it's just not going to happen. I think there, and I'll mention some things from, I've read portions, some substantial part of the BBSG. I intend to read the entire thing, and I will be submitting comments as I have in all the other various rounds for the 2002 and the 2005 standard. But let's look at some of the things that they talk about with regard to the design. The design of things in the BBSG uses a concept of inheritance. It's very much from the object-oriented programming style of inheritance. In other words, there's like a superclass, and then there's other classes that encapsulate that superclass, and then it even says there that you cannot you know, we would call them methods. So it said you can't get rid of anything, you use the word methods, but if you're anybody here in the room who programs in C++ or Java, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so that whole concept of you can't supersede these methods, that's not the way we program in C++ or in Java. You can actually supersede a method with another method. And so what I'm saying is that the design of these sort of inheritance classes that, you know, there's a generic voting system design and then there's other types that are meta designs on top of that, and we have to keep all of the things that the voting system design has, that's not the way we program, and I don't believe that that's the way these designs actually are going to occur. I think that this hierarchical, object-oriented programming style that's developed in, it's very nice, and again, it's very understandable for those of us who are programmers, but I don't believe that it accurately reflects the designs that even currently exist, but it's certainly not the ones in the innovation class. So I think you need to go back and relook at that. Also, as we've all mentioned here, is these definitions. If we do not have a good set of definitions for what is a vote, I looked up what is a vote? It was self-referential, as we would call in programming, recursive. It's a recursive definition because laws were defined inside the, you know, it was defined in terms of laws. So we, you can do a harmonization of terminologies that appears in all the various state laws. Yes, it will be a sort of painful process, but you can drag them all down. There haven't been that many of them. And you can try to figure out the different generic classes of these terminologies. And then you might use those words, but then people can at least understand what our term of vote means this type of vote, and you could come up with these different types of things. So I think that's certainly an important step that needs to be done. I think we, from the discussion, it seems like we all agree on that. One of the things I've been very concerned about for quite a number of years, and actually served on a subcommittee at IEEE Standards Group on voting systems, was to come up with some way of mitigating CODs. This, the, what is being stated in the standard in this current draft is that you could take a CODS product, and as long as you integrate it and it works, then we're going to deem it okay. That does not mean that that CODS product is working correctly. It doesn't mean that its next version, after Microsoft recalls it, or you need to put the patches in, that that's going to integrate properly. We know that sort of thing doesn't work. So CODS, closed source, trade secrecy, as far as I'm concerned, it has no place in voting systems, but it does, it does mitigate concerns of the, what I'll refer to as the for-profit, and it's sort of predisposed to the for-profit organizations. Now, I must just throw in an aside here. I'm really sick and tired of this bellyaching about how much time it's going to take and money to mitigate these problems as far as security is concerned. We heard this from the airbag industry with automobiles. And then when they required that the airbags had to be put in, darned if the airbags were not put in. And they were able to afford to put the airbags in. So all of these things can actually be done. I really have very little time left in the handout. I have quite a few other different things that I listed. One of the things I just want to touch on briefly is security itself. All of these things with regard to security, the standard talks about ISO 9000. That is not a security standard. That is a process standard. It's a manufacturing standard. It has nothing to do with security per se. And we still have not seen a true security document where common criteria would be the standard. And again, that comes under NIST bailiwick. So common criteria would be the thing to do. And common criteria level 4 is actually the first level where you're actually designing to create a secure system. We're dealing with legacy designs, and these legacy designs, we're having overlays and add-ons, and from a security standpoint, we know that absolutely does not work. I've been calling for years. In the 90s, I was saying we should use the TSEC, ITSEC standards. That was never applied to voting systems. For years, I've been saying that we should be applying the common criteria. We haven't seen that be applied yet, and I think we need to go in that direction. So in any event, what I'm saying is that there is a whole category of different problems that are not being appropriately addressed, and I'd like to not see them brushed under the rug. So I have this list here as sort of a first draft of, you know, topics that we should be discussing. I'll entertain questions during the question period. Over to you.
Okay. I'll make this quick because, like Rebecca noted, a lot of discussion about some of the points I have on my list.
Could you tell us your name, please?
sorry. This is Lily Coney, and with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, we focus on privacy, civil liberties, as it relates to constitutional values and practices and policies of corporations and government entities, most notably federal government entities. The first thing I'd like to open up with is to recognize that the only reason we are having discussions about voting system standards and certification testing is because elections officials identified this as a major problem way back in the 80s. And they took their own resources and ingenuity and figured out how to get something on the table, which resulted in the 1990 standards. Love them, don't love them, however you feel about it. That was a monumental effort by a lot of people who are novice to how do you get the federal government to do something it doesn't think it needs to do in the first place. And then how do you get industry to cooperate and elections officials in the 50 states plus territories to go along with the idea. They did a great job in doing that. Now, there were some problems with why it wasn't as effective as maybe we think it ought to have been. It had to do with financing and had to do with clout, the ability to actually draw the line in the sand and say, everybody cross it right now. They couldn't do that. So that being said, we have an opportunity to make up for those two things, as well as build on what they've already started to build on, which is have the resources in play and also have the ability to enforce the standards and enforce the testing and certification process in a way that is beneficial to the elections process. Looking at what's next for voting systems, I have a quick list I'll go through. What's next for voting system standards? We're going to be heavily reliant on standards. We're going to be heavily reliant on effective testing and certification processes. We're not going to get a voting receipt that ties the voter identity to the vote cast, not anytime soon unless something dramatic happens. We need to establish the range of abilities or limitations that can be accommodated by a particular voting system. Looking at the voter and the poll worker as being the customers that need to be supported. Develop a wide range of ballot interfaces and technologies for all the things that we think and know that voting systems need to be able to accomplish. We need to look at testing and certification that is reliable in detecting devices that fail the standards and measures for what testing and certification should be able to do. Creating a failure reporting protocol that allows reporting of problems with elections. Improve transparency of elections from end to end. Establish a minimum criteria that would trigger a suspension of a system and initiate a full investigation of that system. We look at it with the NTSB, we see it with the FDA and recalls. We know this is important in other places in the economy and for our health and benefit to society. People may look at what happened in Florida 2000 with people going in the street and, you know, down in Florida and being very upset about the outcome of the election. And you can pretty much, you know, I don't know how many studies have been done in this, but we can basically probably look at the fact that people thought their candidate didn't win and they were very upset about that. Okay. Fast forward to what we're looking at now. I work in policy. I've done this for a very long time. My foundation, my background was in nonpartisan voter education participation projects. What we're looking at is if people lose faith in the democratic process, the institution of elections, they will not be in the street just in one state or in one city, and they won't be there because a particular candidate did not win. They will be there because they don't believe the process of elections is allowing their voice to be heard, and you're not going to get them to go away by saying we're going to do a study. That's what we're up against. That's the real thing that's out there somewhere in our future if we cannot resolve these issues. And we're on a stopwatch on this. You can talk to Jim Dixon about this. There should be more people from voting advocacy community here because they can tell you what I'm saying. This is where we live. Every day when I was doing this kind of work, that's where they are right now. The other issue is I agree with Rebecca about voting definitions and terms. We need to come to an understanding of what we're talking about. So when we talk, we're talking the same language and hearing the same things. We need an acceptance of the fact that population of voters cannot be defined.
we are not going to be able to pull in a simple definition of what a voter is and what a poll worker is and that satisfy what we need to do with usability and accessibility. We need to collect data points. What is really happening real time on the election day? We need to collect information that doesn't violate the secrecy of the ballot and voter privacy. We need to understand what's happening so we can study it. Researchers can study it. And we need to be able to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges and why there are differences among voting places and where the commonality is. We need to understand that elections have to be fault tolerant. We're going to have failures. We need to understand that right now. How do we still successfully complete an election? Avi Rubin talked about this. I think he's absolutely right. Let's talk in terms of making sure if we're going to have a meltdown, it's a predictable way this system is going to break. We do this in other types of systems. When you talk about system redundancy and assurability, when systems are going to break like traffic lights, they don't all blink green. That's for a reason. So we need to think in those terms when you talk about voting systems. When election day starts, it's running. That's a train that's left the station, and at the end of the day, it's over. So if that means we need to dynamically generate provisional ballots, we need to figure out how to do that on demand. We need to be sure that the system is actually working as intended throughout the election, routinely. So if there's a problem, we can try to identify that in real time, or we're going to have to figure out how we're going to recover and maintain the process. Okay. What we can expect from all of this effort: voting systems that work. That's what people want, and let's be honest about it. Yes, we're talking about how much is this going to cost us. It's not just money, it's in human capital. If poll workers' average age is 72 years old, let's face it, do we need a draft? Are we going to have to get people to volunteer? Are we going to have corporations put down, bottom line, election day, we're going to get paid day for everybody who's willing to work at a polling location, plus some extra vacation time. We're going to have to be creative about this stuff, okay? New entrants into the vending market, the manufacturer market, we've got to figure out how do we create opportunities. Do we have to have a grant program, a lottery program of some type to pay for the testing and certification for new entrants that meet a certain standard, a certain level? We got to figure out how we're going to maintain this. Accountability at every level of the process. There have to be real consequences, but also real rewards for those who get it right. Turnover of elections officials is just natural. We're human beings. We have finite career paths. But how do we develop new next generation of elections officials that will come on board and help us continue with this process? Elections will forever have winners and losers. How do we deal with that? Do we leave that to the courts? What challenges exist? A full suite of election audit procedures from end to end. We have to deal with voter alienization. This is a real issue. And how do we do that together and still have the needed conversations that we need to have amongst ourselves, real conversations about what's going on? Professional development of elections administrators. We need to learn from the actual election process. We need to build collaboration among everyone. Technologists speak very well to each other. Elections officials speak very well to each other. Election advocates speak very well with each other. We need to be talking with each other, figure out how to communicate effectively with each other. We need greater transparency. The EAC process compared with the previous process, universe apart. And it's not because NASAD and the others did not want to do transparency. They didn't have the resources. NASAD has never had a headquarters with staff. They've had secretariats that have managed the testing and certification process. The EAC has a headquarters. It has staff. What else do they need in order to make sure this process delivers on the expectations? We need to keep the door for innovation open. We've got to, because as I said, the whole population of poll workers, the whole population of voters, everybody. So we're gonna have to keep pushing and working to make sure it's as inclusive as possible for the full range of democracy benefits, which includes a secret ballot. We need to figure out how election failures are managed. Elections administrators are so used to having the one election out of the thousands that they've run go wrong and get blamed. And their jobs are literally put on the line for it. So the tendency is not to report things when they go wrong or problems when they go wrong. And their only friend previously was the manufacturer who sold them the system. They could call them in the dead of the night. these people would come from wherever they needed to come with whatever resources they needed in order to figure out how to fix it. What happened in Florida was a worst case scenario for any elections official, and it's still the case. How do we address the fact that, yes, we're going to have failures, but we need to hear about them? We need you telling us about them, and you don't need to be silenced or threatened or feel like you're about to put an end to your career because you said you had a problem. Do we need whistleblower protection? Do we need other things to ensure that there is stability and we can encourage that level of communication and honesty when things aren't going well? And then we need a notice and alert protocol. Do we need to have a system where voters can report problems, elections officials can report problems, vendors can report problems, and do you need to have a level of responsibility in reporting problems? Because if we get the problems, then we can have something we can work on, so we do need people to communicate when there are problems. And if the vendors may be the first one to be to identify a problem, how do we encourage them to do that in a positive way? And then, of course, evolution and thought about what is an effective and efficient public election. And we're going to always have battles over voting system economic. Well, we have a problem because the voting system economic model is weird, okay? This is equivalent to Maserati manufacturing. I mean, you know, there are some people who can buy a $100,000 automobile. I don't know any of them, okay? But there are some people out there. And that economic model, it may be the closest thing to what we're asking voting equipment vendors to do. Now, if we're talking about comparing these Maserati or these high-end $100,000 cars with the Ford pickup truck, and we expect for this model to work like that model, we know that's not realistic. So how do we address this very weird economic model? And I agree we do need to study it, and I'm glad to hear Commissioner Hunter talk about this, because we don't understand this economic model. It doesn't work like anything else we have in a very capitalistic driven economy. And I do understand vendors and manufacturers, I'm going to call you something, I do want to identify how you identify yourselves, but you have stockholders, you have owners, and you cannot say you're going along with increasing the cost of your product because someone asked you to do it. Your job is to resist these things. And what the policy formation environment has to figure out is what's realistic, like the automobile manufacturers saying, we cannot put airbags in cars because it will just put us out of business, versus a few years later doing commercials talking about how great the airbags are.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's what policymakers have to do. But in order for them to do that, they have to hear from manufacturers, they have to hear from advocates, they have to hear from elections officials. And we want, as the policy that EPIC pursues in this regard, is transparency. So having an opportunity for people to be called as witnesses before decision-making bodies, boards, committees, that's very good for the process. If you don't do a public transparent means for people to communicate, they may seek out other means for communicating which won't be as transparent. So it's good to have transparency. I'm not advocating for participation on committees or any of those things. I'm not in a position to say what's going to make sense in this particular environment. But I would caution that the government decision-making authorities cannot pick winners and losers of technology. If you certify a standard that's to a vendor's design standard that's existent, then what do you do if others want to build to that design? Do they infringe on somebody's copyright if they do that? Do you cause other problems if you write a standard that's so close to another's that they actually say they have a copyright on the software is copywritten? That you infringe on trade secrets, which may get into other areas because they're trying to meet that standard. But anyway, that's it.
Automatically in 5 minutes.
Whoops.
Okay.
Is David Shum online? Was he going to talk?
David
or was
and he is not.
And he has left. We were going to have a 10-minute like discussion among the panelists before we open it to questions. That was how we had originally planned. And I'd like to reply to your or add to your thing about these error reports. I was very happy to see that the EAC is finally going to be collecting error reports. It was something I had proposed a number of years ago, and actually had even proposed it in some grants that I didn't unfortunately receive. But I think there's a concern about these open-ended vulnerability tests that have been listed in the VBSG, that you can run these open-ended vulnerability tests during the testing phase, but you also have the, you know, using phase when all of this equipment is out there, and it doesn't stop then. So in other words, when the stuff is in the field and you have other breakdowns, or, you know, if a company is found to have, you know, put 111 as their password in all their machines, and all the keys are all keyed exactly the same on all their machines, well, this, we need to have a process for reporting all of this information, and then we need a process for decertification. We've seen a few things get decertified. We've even seen a few of the ITAs get decertified from doing ITA types of duties. But I think there isn't really a very valid and well thought out process for decertification. There's, you know, we give the certifications out to these machines, they get the imprimatur on them, they're allowed to sell them, and now, you know, California comes up with, you know, their list of complaints. Now the EAC is, you know, posting it, at least now we're getting it posted, you know, in a centralized location, so we can see all these reports, you know, of problems and errors and, you know, all sorts of security vulnerabilities, but then nothing is being done about that. So, you know, in the past, you would have, you know, complaints and breakdowns, and then maybe a state would decertify their stuff, or a municipality would say, well, we're not using that anymore, we'll buy something else. But then other states are still using the exact same equipment that this other state has decertified. Oh, we haven't had any problems with it yet. Well, you might. So we need to have a process for decertification for recall. I mean, we recall products. Now they're recalling all the stuff that's made in China. It's sad to say, but, you know, I mean, we have processes for this, but we don't have these processes for the boning machines. And with regard to updates, I mean, if you're going to use COTS products, then you have to have some way of disseminating these updates and ensuring that all the updates are properly installed. Yes, you're not on the internet, so you don't have those vulnerabilities, et cetera, et cetera. If you're not going to use RF transmissions, you won't have those vulnerabilities, but you may still have other vulnerabilities. We found out, you know, problems with the touch screens that were manufactured in South America. So, you know, there are problems, and these problems need to be reflected in decertification, recall, dissemination of information, and there needs to be an orderly process for doing this. It shouldn't be a blanket certification that you get it and then it's up to the election officials to decide whether they want to get rid of the stuff. Also, I want to just...
This is David Chong.
Oh, David, you're back. Okay.
I've been online the whole time. I don't know what...
He's talking about...
I dialed in. I don't know why.
David, this is Daniel Castro. We're about to get cut off, so give me your phone number. I'll call you back. All right. I'll call you back if we get cut off. And I'm sorry for those of you that are listening online. We're not going to be able to continue it for you. But we will post the audio later online.
David, you should speak.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Great. I've got one slide. Is that teed up?
It's getting there.
It's coming up.
Okay. You don't have to put it up yet. Let me begin my remarks by saying that I find that the BVSG draft that we're looking at reflects a tremendous breakthrough. And the reason I say that is because for the first time, essentially, it's been acknowledged that design standards are insufficient and that performance testing is needed in voting systems certification work. And of course, one of the key example of that is the so-called...
I think you just got cut off.
Yeah.
That was it. Okay.
I think I can bring him on Skype.
I can just dial.
No, just call. Let's call.
Hey, and, all right, I think we're done.
Yeah, just call. Wipe that out. Yes. Yeah. Leave that out. Everybody, be gone.
Yes, hello.
David.
Am I back on the air?
Yeah, you're the only one now.
Well, okay. What a privilege. So, yes, as I was saying, the open-ended vulnerability testing, so-called red team, is included in the current draft. Is a breakthrough. It's new. It's probably the only way to solve the problem, and I think it's a huge sea change. And also in the usability testing area, I mean, the really excellent work has also been included. That's maybe perhaps not so open-ended, but essentially performance-based testing. So, is my slide up now?
No, not yet.
One minute.
Coming up. One more minute.
Okay. But, so, I think there are, we're almost halfway there. It's up? Okay. I put a star next to, there's a bit of an echo, each of the two items that I mentioned. We already have some performance-based testing standard for. And that really only leaves, in my view, sort of two other broad areas, and I use colors here, sort of, well, like the red team has a color. So the purple one is the whole privacy, resistance to improper influence, and what some have called the democracy property, keeping the tally secret until the results are supposed to be announced. It strikes me that that's a whole aspect which can be only really addressed by an adversarial, open-ended testing process. So we need a purple team to try to find vulnerabilities along those lines. Then if we look down at the need for a green team, if you will, as was proven in California, the only way to really find out if the systems are reliable or not is to just vote the heck out of them, to run them in a real simulated election and vote many, many times on them and so forth. That basically, those California volume tests essentially proved that all the standard shake and bake junk, which has been built in since the 90s in the federal standards, is really irrelevant, and that what you need to do if you want to know if a voting system, and you'll notice the word system in the title of my slide, it's not about the machines, as we've heard, it's about the system. If you want to know if the system's going to be reliable, and we've had a lot of trouble with reliability of systems, it's been widely reported, the only way to do it is to run systems and see how reliable they are. And I don't think that either this robustness green team effort or the purple team, which is very similar to the red team, really just different goals in mind, are difficult things to imagine how to describe or organize or specify. So I would maintain that we're basically now essentially halfway towards having a way to measure the performance of voting systems, and that's what we need. And anything short of that is ineffective. And of course, as we've heard, design standards bring a lot of problems with them, not the least of which is unnecessary cost because of, I won't go into all the pitfalls with the sort of process that's underway, but essentially we are now poised to be able to allow voting systems to be properly tested in terms of their performance against this full set of criteria. I believe this is a sufficient set. If anyone has any comments on that later, I'd love to discuss them. The final point I'd like to make is a concrete proposal. You know, as Arthur said, we don't have a solution, or Sandy said, I guess, we don't have a problem until we have no way to, there could be a solution. Well, let me make a very specific proposal to move forward from where we are today, and that is the following. That without delay, the federal government of the EAC finishes the half work that's been done here and announces the performance testing methods for the remaining properties without delay, and then allows anyone who has a system that wants to have it tested against those to do so without delay. There's no need to wait for a VVSG to be approved in 2009 and then to slot this in and then wait for the labs to gear up and so on. Makes no sense. Once you know how these tests can be done, you're ready to allow the testing to begin. Now, I'm not saying to throw away the VVSG and all the design standard work that's in there from dating from from the 90s, but why not keep that as well and allow the vendors to, you know, keep having their system certified based on those design requirements, which more or less codify their existing systems, and to allow others to submit their systems to testing and provide two independent parallel avenues for federal certification of voting systems in our country, sort of open things up and create a real marketplace to do all the good things that I think, you know, we've heard a great deal about at this very interesting workshop. That's essentially what I wanted to say. I'd be happy to entertain any questions related to this.
Questions? Floor is open. Any questions?
How many of these aspects that David has put on his slide are currently inside the VSG?
Well, in a way, pretty much all of them are, but in some of them in a very, you know, modest way. Like reliability, the 2005 standard was using mean time between failures, which is an appropriate metric. It's used in engineering all the time. Problem was that the number was too low. It allowed for about a 9% failure rate during a normal election day. So that was inappropriate. Now, to replace that with volume testing, that's also inappropriate. Volume testing is one thing. Mean time between failures is another thing. You should pick an appropriate mean time between failures number and then also do volume testing. So you know, it's been in there. A lot of these things have been in there, but they've been in there incorrectly or in an inappropriate engineering way that they, you know, they didn't really satisfy the needs as far as,
perhaps,
as the systems.
Perhaps I could respond to the question even though it addressed me in the third person.
Make your day.
For one thing, I tried to argue, and I don't mean to contradict Rebecca, it's a very dangerous thing to do, but let me just say that I do believe that volume testing is a more effective means than the mean time between failures and the shake and bake and all of that. I think you could make a volume testing which is more realistic, where you run it at different room temperatures and in different amounts of, you know, sand and dust, and you drop the stuff on the scene there. So I think this gives you a much higher level of overall assurance. That the problem, what we've seen proof of in the media, is that the kind of performance of reliability testing that we've had in the past, which is all laboratory-based shake and bake and so forth, didn't really result in systems that were reliable. We're looking at failure rates, you know, of 10-20% in a lot of reported cases, and God knows what in other cases. So I think what you need to do is a real comprehensive, realistic volume testing. I think it would be sufficient. If you want to do, you know, complement that with laboratory testing, fine. I don't have, you know, an issue with that. The question I think was which aspects are in the current standard and which are not. I mean, of course, they're all the issues are sort of addressed. But what I was trying to say is that for integrity, the red team, you know, the tallied as recorded and tallied, I mean, say tallied as cast kind of property, if you will, or at least the part of it that's in the scope of the current standard, that is something that I believe is well addressed by open-ended vulnerability studies, and I think that's really the only effective way to address it. I added, you know, resistance to denial of service because I'm not sure that's included in there, and it has a certain adversarial nature, whereas robustness is the same issues without, you know, when you assume there's no adversary. I think that the ballot secrecy issues, just to cover the final point, have been in the standard since the 90s, in the original standards, but apparently no one's, you know, the standards really only seem to apply to people who want to innovate in the voting space. They don't seem to apply to the existing, to the vendors. And so, in fact, all the products that are out there don't seem to offer much in terms of privacy or, you know, according to what I read in the press. But I think that the only way to really assess the resistance of a system to threats against privacy or so-called improper influence threats and, you know, keeping the tally secret, because this isn't, abuses of this do occur and they are reported, is by a similar kind of, you know, purple team, open-ended vulnerability assessment. You just have to turn people loose and let them try to figure out the easiest way to violate those properties with a particular system. And that's the only real way to do it. And it's, you know, if once you have set up a way to do that for the integrity properties, it's pretty easy just to, you know, go in with your word processor and change it to privacy properties and use the same methodology and the same. So that one is almost already done.
David, this is Lily. I wanted to get another, we have a couple more questions that we want to get in. Did you want to wrap up your reply?
I did wrap up my reply.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting into other people's question time.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Just a very quick comment, Bill Edelstein, John Hopkins, on what Lily said, and that is the remarkable lack of data on this process. And the reason is at least twofold. One is it occurs very, you know, infrequently, like you have a presidential election with lots of people every 4 years. And second, there are actual legal obstacles. You can't just go in there and have lots of people standing around and writing things down. So there is a group at University of California, Berkeley, that has applied for grants to actually do this. And they called me up and I talked to them about it. So, you know, they want to know things like, what's the statistics of people arriving? How long does it take people to vote? Are there long lines for them? All these other things. And nobody actually knows this at the moment. Of course, the California Secretary of State just messed things up by banning DREs in California. So we'll have to see what happens.
I wanted to answer that. I think that that raises an important point, is that, again, we only get the certification. You get a certification number. And some of these tests provided real data that could have been used. Like the shake and bake test would have revealed the fact that the batteries, after a certain number of, you know, months sitting around in the warehouses without being charged, can't get charged up properly. And so there is useful data that came out in those tests, but because, again, of trade secrecy and because the evaluation was allowed to remain secret, we didn't get that data out, so now we were forced to just collect the data in an ad hoc fashion. So again, you know, I know that there is supposedly a little bit more of an openness with regard to at least what is going to be tested. So I think there's supposed to be some reporting on that, but I think that there should be some results on, you know, well, how long are you going to be able to keep those machines? You're going to have to throw them out after 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. The shake and bake test will reveal that. So, you know, we will know that information, but if it's not provided to the people who are buying it, then they're left in the dark.
Can I just chime in and in support of the, as a panelist here, the open-ended testing of these four properties that I listed, point out that yes, then we would not only have a yes or no result of whether or not systems allowed to be sold or not, but we'd also know its strengths and weaknesses relative to other systems and in an absolute sense as well. And I think that would allow those buying the systems to, you know, make the right choice for their jurisdiction and allocate resources properly. You know, if it requires a lot of extra outside of the machine work to keep the integrity, then that has a cost. You know, they should know when they're buying the system how much of that stuff is needed in order to maintain integrity, or, you know, how long people are going to sit in the booths voting and so forth and so on. So, yeah, that's just...
So it's open
goes
results.
To show that
results of the testing.
A performance-based testing is so much more useful than a design standard. It gives much more useful information, which allows more effective deployment of the equipment, and both in terms of cost and in terms of achieving the properties that are desired.
Thanks. I think I saw Alan's hand, and then
gentleman in. Okay.
Yeah, David, you talk a lot about performance standard versus design standard. Frankly, I don't see a lot of design standard in this document. What, maybe you can define that for us, the difference between performance standard and design standard.
Well, I think that the commissioner mentioned that this in her opening remarks, and I mean, there is an, if you were to go to the NIST archives, you would find that a former director of NIST wrote an article on just that topic. And if you read the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the technology sub-agreement that the U.S. is a signatory to, you will find that the United States government has committed to not use design standards at any level of public procurement, at any level of government. That is a treaty obligation that we have. So even if it's a voluntary federal standard, if any subdivision of government at any level were to make a procurement decision based on such a design standard, this would be a violation of GATT for the United States. So, I mean, it's a very well-known notion in the standards world. Design standards are intended, by way of answering your question, definition, basically to protect markets. The reason you use design standards is so that certain suppliers are the only ones who can get the contracts.
Right, exactly.
That's the reason they're used. They have nothing to do with the quality of what's resolved or you know, achieving public goods or economy or anything like that. It's merely a kind of barrier to trade, whether the reason for it may be corruption and collusion, malfeasance generally, or it may be protectionist. But that's the bare facts of the matter.
I think the question was, do you think that the VVSG, as you see it now, is a performance or a design standard?
Well, I remember reading the earlier versions, like the 92 standard and the whatever the other one was. They always tried to say that they were a performance standard. If you see how far out of their way they go to setting their performance standard, when in fact it's a design standard, it's kind of very telling. Now, of course, at the bottom line, you know, it is subjective. You cannot just look at a piece of paper and say, this is the performance standard or this is the design standard. It's kind of subjective and it's kind of relative. But, look, I want to commend the efforts of everyone who's been involved in working on this standard. As I said, I think it reflects a breakthrough. And, you know, there are a lot of different influences on this process, and the fact that these results have come through is tremendous. So I think we should, you know, run with the successes here and not try to focus on, you know, pointing fingers. I would say that the current standard is far less of a design standard than previous versions, and you know, and I don't have a problem with offering a design standard as an option, but if it's an exclusive design standard, then there are huge structural issues, and many of them I've heard, you know, repeated over and over during this really interesting workshop.
Okay, this is Lily. I wanted to ask, are there any more clarifying questions related to this topic?
The difference is, one of the things I want to get to is the difference.
Let me go to him, and then we can go back to you. Okay.
Let me make two points as quickly as I possibly can. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. My name is John Cugini. I work with Cugini Consultants. With respect to definitions, David made a point that the line between them is a little slippery. Very broadly, design standard says what it looks like, a functional standard says what it's capable of doing, and a performance standard says how well it can do it. Okay, now fine. Now take those guidelines and look at a requirement and decide whether a given requirement is a functional or a design standard. In most cases, it'll be pretty clear. In some cases, it won't be. I like performance standards as well as anyone. I was involved with the development of usability performance standards. But the poor maligned design standards, there's sometimes reasons for doing them. For instance, we have a design standard that says fonts will be at least 3 millimeters. Or we have design standards about how things are shaped so wheelchairs can approach a voting machine. They're not put in there to restrict trade. They're put in there because they're pretty well accepted. Secondly, when you get to testing, test procedures for design standards, if nothing else, can be pretty objective because they're pretty specific. The higher level the requirement is, the more subjective the testing gets. So if, for instance, you have a requirement that the voting system shall be accessible, that's a great requirement. I think we're all in favor of it. That's a it's a functional standard. Okay, now how do you test it? Well, gee, that's, who gets to decide whether it's really accessible? What does that test suite look like? Now you move the questions down into the test suite. So, there are sometimes reasons to put in design requirements as well as performance requirements.
Okay, I wanted to go to David Byrne,
yes.
And then come back.
Comments. One is that, as far as I can see it, within the design requirement, software independence as it's defined within the new draft, it's basically saying it's either a DRE with a VDPAT or an optical scan valid. That, to me, is very limited as to what the trade is. Now, I represent right. members who offer those solutions. I have nothing to lose if it's decided that's what it's going to look like. However, from an industry standpoint, that is extremely limiting as to the options that are available. Other than the innovation class, which remains this kind of pie-in-the-sky, very vague description requiring a several panel review as to what is legitimately an innovation. The other comment I had was with regards to open-ended vulnerability testing, and I think that there's legitimate discussion points to have that Dr. Mercury brought up. However, I think I go back to my earlier comments with the current dynamic is that it is vendor-driven in finance, because then they are expecting some result to say, yes, I have achieved certification. And that is all that the customer should be aware of for the most part, to say, yes, I have achieved all of the objectives. Everyone from that point forward is equal. Because it's either pass, fail at the end of the process. But during that process, the manufacturer is looking for feedback, looking to improve his product, to bring it to the point that they can bring it to market. So it's just a different dynamic, because I think what you're describing is one in which it has not been refinanced, but it's one in which it is a pass-fail criteria. What are the
we don't know. We don't know what the benchmark is. There's nobody knows.
I want to make a comment.
But not during. I agree with you. Not during. But I'm just saying, once it's passed, then say what level at.
Well, the concern there is that if you're revealing that beyond just saying the product is certified to all the standards,
but you have to have the performance of them, so
right.
then you know what they are.
In the voting performance protocol, but
then at least you have those levels.
The standpoint is that it can be used as a marketing tool within the competitive environment. From one vendor to the next, saying, well, they didn't perform adequately in this area or in this area.
Okay, please respond, and then I'll make a comment. David.
So what we're really talking about here at base is whether or not we are going to tap into the, American ingenuity and competitiveness. Pardon me, sorry, that's a little cold here. That's really responsible for driving this, all the developments in our country in order to achieve the thing that we say we're aspiring to, which is to bring, to improve democracy. But let's just keep in mind that what we're doing here in the United States in these voting system standards, it's not just a bureaucratic exercise. It has real impact on the United States, on voter confidence here, that's for sure. But we're also setting an example for the rest of the world. And I think we should be very careful about what we do and to try to really achieve the highest level that we can and to open up the kind of processes which have built this great country and to allow them to reach their potential and help make the world more democratic. And we really need this now. It's becoming more and more important.
Okay.
Voter confidence in the United States is continuing to drop, according to Pew surveys.
Okay, this is Lily. I had one thing I'd like to say. We're talking about where the line should be, and this is another discussion around how vendor or manufacturers can be, voices can be heard in the development of policy and standards and all of that. If you're at the table as a witness or as a person who's submitting comments or something like that, that's one thing. But if you're at the dais, at the
podium or part of the decision-making body, then you get into other discussions about what's going on. But there are a couple of things with the standards process and with even the testing and certification process that I wanted to put on the table. At one point, when you do the standards and you certify software as is, this is the way it ought to be, it passes standards, but you get within a couple of weeks of an election and you talk about wanting to put in a patch, a software patch or something like that, you really are getting across the line with voter confidence, and all the players in the game will be okay with that. And how transparent is that going to be, and how do you rationalize that after a process that was so expensive, so time-consuming, so deliberative, to within a few weeks of an election say, oops, we missed something, and so we have to do this because about this jurisdiction or this locale or this ballot or something, and we have to resolve that. I want to ask this question and make this statement and allow the panel participants to kind of contribute to that, and then I'll open it up for questions from the...
Right, and I think part of the problem with the certifications, I dealt with a recount situation in Ohio where we found out after a lot of FOIA requests, we found out that the various modules were not integrated properly, and there was two separate certifications. There was like five components from one certification and five from another, and the EAC specifically says that the certification has to be in the configuration that was certified, and so that whole election should have been thrown out, but it didn't get thrown out. And then the vendor said, you know, on the stand that, well, we tested it and we don't think that there were any problems, but we don't know because it wasn't certified in that configuration. The other thing I was trying to say about these benchmarks is that when I buy a car, I know in the book it says how often I have to have the oil changes, so it's based on my mileage and my usage. So if we know that all voting machines that are certified, all their batteries are going to crap out at 18 months, then the communities can set aside money so that they can buy those new batteries. But if we just know, oh, they all passed, you know, you can then say, you know, market them with, you know, well, we put 24-month batteries in or whatever. You know, you're welcome to do that, and then it's, you know, up to provability. But still, I think that it's doing a disservice to the communities to not know what the benchmark was. What was the level at which all this equipment was passed, so that way when they encounter these problems, it's not such a shock. And when other communities buy that same equipment, you know, they don't come up with the same shock, you know. So that's all I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to say that you can, you know, that you should, you know, the height of the benchmark, you know, how you compared to it, but at least what the baseline was, and that's not been really provided. So
I'm going to let Dave have a comment. Dave, do you have something?
Yes, I'm still here. Yeah, okay. I'd like to make a comment.
Okay.
And my comment is in two parts. One is Rick Carback still there?
Yes.
Rick, stand up so we can see who you are. Rick has, from what I understand, done a great thing of putting the whole draft up in a way that people can easily comment on it in the more familiar sort of /dot style of thing, and I think that's really appropriate. And I hope everyone will take advantage of that and stay in touch with Rick about that when it's just in beta right now or pre-beta. The other thing, related to that is the VSPR effort, and the reason, which is very similar. And the reason I'm mentioning these things is because, in some sense, the problem is really on the shoulders of the people in the room there. And on the shoulders of like people, because really, as Arthur pointed out in the VSPR thing, you don't have to wait for the federal government to make standards. You could go ahead and make standards yourself. That's what the IEEE tried to do. And they did that based on an Office of Management and Budget guideline, which said that if there were public standards, accredited public standards, then the government cannot make standards in that area. Okay, this is a fact. Now, the point is, we're epsilon away now from having a set of tests that would test the efficacy of voting systems in a very clear, you know, and comprehensive and reliable way. the federal government and the NIST, I guess, and the EAC have done a lot of the heavy lifting in designing some of these procedures and so forth. All we have to do is just kind of take those and fill in the missing pieces by more or less copying, and we could create our own document that would be a testing standard. Then there'd be something to talk about, something to compare against. And I've urged people that are interested in that to contact me and Arthur and try to do that in the context of VSPR, because there is a democratic, open, transparent forum in which was set up to facilitate things like that. So
okay.
That's my comment.
Okay, thanks, David. Yeah. David Byrne had a comment, and then I'll go to...
speak to what Dr. Mercury was talking about with regards to the notion of, just like you look at a vehicle, you're looking at mileage standards and things like that. I think that's exactly where you could go, but I think you can tread carefully and balance what you're looking for versus what the industry standard might be, which is where the EAC can play an important role as well, to say, once all of the products go through and become EAC certified,
right.
Stripping the vendors' names,
right.
Developing an industry standard, say, here's what we are projecting for the life cycle of equipment. Potentially, that's where those standards come from.
That's right,
where you're not interfering with the marketplace. You're just simply saying, here's what we've identified as the standard. And we've done this as an industry with regards to the durability of thermal records, looking
right.
at all of the individual platforms. I look at them, I strip all the names off, and I look at what the standard is. And whether or not the durability can withstand the 22
right,
months,
22 months right.
those environmental factors are adhered to.
Right.
The other issue that was brought up was with regards to software upgrades, and that's a very important one that gets lost in this, and that is, because it is state-driven, it is oftentimes one in which a vendor who may have not identified certain states they want to approach for selling a product end up deciding they want to. So that means that they may have to accommodate ballot rotation, straight party voting, other features that were not originally included within the software. So they have to resubmit that product for certification. The question is, how much bang do you get for your buck? And if it becomes too costly, you have to decide when you're going to strategically maximize your investment. But there's also an additional problem, for example, this year, in which products that are perhaps state-driven changes, because of the delays in certification currently, they have not been accommodated as of yet. And so vendors, like they do oftentimes, have to build procedures around that fact and develop either some other solution that will allow them to accomplish their state legislative requirement while maintaining their federally certified product. And that's where there's a disconnect between the real challenges from the manufacturing angle versus public perception. And that's where I think today's event has been a wonderful one, just for allowing us to be part of the dialogue. And we certainly appreciate it.
Okay, we have time for one more question. I'm going to go to the gentleman back who we haven't heard from other than his panel participation.
I just want to say today this is a point again. Far more frequently than any scenario of 11th hour software upgrade package that has been offered in this room is that when the jurisdiction approaches their established vendor and says, I want four columns on my report, you only offer three. I want to put my candidates in rotation order as they appear on this ballot style, rather than either in alphabetical order or by who got the most votes and who got the least votes. Far more frequently, the 11th hour patches are due to jurisdictional requests where the gun is to the vendor's head.
Okay, well, the only thing I would add to that is that transparency has to be addressed in both contexts, whether you're talking about where you give minimum standards for changing battery life or something like that. Our preference would be for you, if you're selling me an automobile and I'm going to compare, I need to see all the names of the automobiles, the make and models, and then I can decide the average miles per gallon and the times I want to do, that I'll need to do maintenance things. So I need, if I'm telling elections officials to use this stuff, to be able to make these decisions, they probably need to know which vendor and what the parameters for that kind of maintenance information would be. I want to go to one last question, and then we can go ahead and wrap it up if we have any. Otherwise, I think this is a sign that it was a very successful and good opportunity to talk because people were so engaged. Do we have any questions? Any additional? Okay. Thank you so much for staying, and we really enjoyed being here.
I want to thank Dan for for riding herd over this whole thing. He put up with a lot of abuse over the last few weeks, so please give him a round of applause.
We do have the afternoon open if anyone wants to stick around and talk, but it's been a long 5 hours, so I don't blame anyone who wants to leave, too.